Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The East Coast is bracing for Hurricane Florence, which could be the worst storm to come ashore in decades. The Carolinas will be especially hard hit. However, the path of Florence appears to be going more to the northwest after making landfall. Pennsylvania may not see much of an impact from Florence, but there are other hurricanes behind Florence in the Atlantic Ocean. This comes after weeks of record rainfall in our region. To discuss all this meteorology and all this wet weather, Eric Hurst, director of the Millersville University Weather Information Center. Mr. Hurst, welcome to the program.
Hello, Scott. Nice to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Eric, let's start with Florence and the impact on Pennsylvania. Do we know yet? Or, you know, I know there are some potential out there, some models, computer models. But what do you think, what do you see the path of Florence taking and the impact on Pennsylvania?
Right. Well, Florence is moving west-northwest toward the North Carolina coast. It will make landfall late tonight or tomorrow near Wilmington, North Carolina. So that's way to our south and too far away to have any initial impact on us. About the, you know, I can see some spotty drizzle developing around our area Friday from an easterly flow off the Atlantic, but that's only kind of indirectly affiliated with Florence, and the main event is down in the Carolinas. And the good news is, as it moves inland and weakens, it's going to spend the weekend over the southern Appalachians. I guess it's bad news for those folks that it's going to be raining heavily over the southern Appalachians this weekend. But the good news is kind of an area of blocking high pressure is what's going to be building over the Commonwealth across the northeast over the weekend, and that keeps the system way to our south. So right now, I think we're going to have a dry weekend, which is kind of a novel concept for us. We haven't had many dry weekends here in central Pennsylvania in recent months, and this one looks dry. Early next week's a different story as remnant moisture comes our way, and there is the chance of some heavy rain come Tuesday with the remnants of Florence. It would be kind of the leftovers coming up our way.
So when you say heavy rain, I saw one model this morning that said that there are some areas of Pennsylvania, if it moves, the remnants of Florence are in more eastern Pennsylvania along the mountains, that we could get like up to 4 inches of rain in a 12-hour period. Do you see rain that heavy?
That's certainly possible. And, you know, given how wet it's been and how waterlogged the ground is, a 4-inch rain, especially over a large area, if much of the state saw that, would cause some significant problems. Now, it's still, 5 or 6 days away from that moisture flowing up here. Again, high pressure protects us this weekend. So I think the earliest I would see rain developing here would be maybe midday Monday, or maybe even late in the day Monday, with then the steadiest or heaviest rain coming Monday night into Tuesday. And then, you know, where does the track of this remnant go, Scott? It could end up more out in Ohio west of the mountains than over in our neck of the woods here east of the mountains. And if so, then there just may be showers and perhaps an inch of rain, which would not be problematic. But, you know, as you said, there are a couple of model solutions that bring the remnants pretty much right up the spine of the Appalachians early next week. And in that scenario, a tropical air mass, and, you know, the mountains kind of can enhance the rainfall, that would be the scenario where maybe over the course of 24 hours there could be even 5 or 6 inches of rain. But again, that's not the official forecast just yet.
Is it difficult to predict the track of a storm like Florence?
Well, you know, initially, you know, as in the past week, No, because when Florence formed out way out in the Atlantic, it actually started as a wave coming off of Africa. It was embedded in the easterlies, the wind flow across the Atlantic, moving east to west and coming underneath a large subtropical ridge. So that track, you know, to the west-northwest was pretty easy to forecast, was pretty easy to see. Now, the system did encounter a bit of a mid-Atlantic trough, and, you know, maybe 5 or 6 days ago, we were thinking, hey, maybe it has a chance of turning north, like towards Bermuda. But once it got past that trough, then it was destined to be carried by this ridge right towards the Carolina coast. And so that path, fairly straightforward to forecast, with the exception of that little troughy encounter. Once these things reach land, especially in this case, because there's kind of a blocking ridge, it gets more difficult because it's going to be moving into a zone of much weaker flow. And so while up to this point, you might think of Florence as being a block of wood floating in a floating down a stream in, you know, with steady flow, this weekend Florence becomes like a block of wood in a pond. And you have a block of wood in a pond where there's no currents, it's pretty hard to say where that block of wood is going to be floating an hour or a day from now. And so that's kind of the situation we're heading into for the weekend. There's more uncertainty.
It has been downgraded. Florence has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm.
That's right.
There were predictions earlier in the week that it would hit land as a Category 4. What does that mean? I mean, that seems to say that the storm is nowhere near as strong as it was earlier in the week, but we're still being told that this is one of the most dangerous storms to hit the East Coast in some time.
Yeah, everything you said is absolutely correct. Florence was a major hurricane, a Category 4, and a couple days ago the thinking was, hey, it's going to maintain that strength right up to landfall, which that would make it one of the strongest storms to hit the East Coast in most people's lifetimes down there, I think since Hazel back in the 50s. Fortunately, it's weakened, and it's now Category 2, which is still a strong storm. Central pressure of 954 millibars is still a very strong storm and has maximum sustained winds of 110 miles per hour, and when it makes when it reaches the Outer Banks and the coastal region, it's going to have a storm surge up to 12 or 13 feet. So there's going to be a lot of flooding and catastrophic damage in locations. But because it's weaker, the absolute wind speed is much less. It's going to be maybe 100 to 110 reaching the coast instead of 140 or higher. And so that's a big difference in terms of the wind damage. But in terms of storm surge, in terms of inland flooding, not much difference. You know, this thing moves inland and stalls, 20 to 30 inches of rain can fall. As you get back into the mountains, that can really be problematic. Along the coast, the rain can drain out a little more quickly, but you get into those inland ridge valley areas and, 20 to 30 inches would potentially cause catastrophic inland flooding. So it's still a big ticket storm, but yes, it has weakened a bit.
And I heard something this morning. This is obviously the big news story of the day and actually this week, is that the category going down from a 4 to a 2, kind of as you just described it, but I just wanted to clarify that actually the windstorm is what is, judged. That's what determines what category it's in, correct?
Yeah, wind and central pressure. They have a formula that they follow pretty closely that gives some objective guidelines to what category it's going to be, and so that that allows you to compare storm to storm, and in storms over history you can compare. But still, each storm is unique in terms of how large it is. Sometimes a storm can have very strong winds and be a Cat 4, but it's very condensed, consolidated, and only impacts a small area with that. And other storms are more spread out. And so every storm has kind of that unique character. And with this system, one of the unique aspects that I don't think's been actually observed here before is a system that when it reaches the North Carolina coast will actually turn left and possibly follow the coast or very close to the coast moving south and west. You know, typically when these hurricanes or tropical storms reach the East Coast, they tend to curve northward and move up along the coast, like towards New England and back out to sea. But this one's going to curve the other direction, and that's quite novel. And of course, it's going to do so very slowly, which extends the exposure to the storm surge, the heavy rain, the wind. And so it's going to have an extended period of impact down there.
Mm. So I want to kind of switch topics on you for a moment, Eric. So Florence will have to wait a few days to see how Pennsylvania will be impacted.
That's right.
From earlier in the week predictions, it doesn't look like we're going to get as much as what we had thought. But what's with the rain? I mean, I don't know how else to put it. The last few weeks, what a summer this has been since mid-July. It's either been rain or 90-degree temperatures and, like, nothing in between. There were a few days in between. You mentioned weekends. I think I saw yesterday on Penn Live that we've had four weekends without rain since the beginning of the summer. Why so much rain in central Pennsylvania this year?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, the simple answer is, you know, we've been stuck in kind of the same jet stream flow pattern for the last 2 months, really dating back to the middle part of July. There's been this persistent southwesterly flow coming from the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, if you go 10,000 feet above the ground right now over top of Harrisburg and observe the winds, they're coming from the southwest, and if you could track them back to where they began or where they're coming from, it's out of the Gulf of Mexico. And that has been the flow regime here, it seems, week in and week out for the last 2 months, is the flow from the Gulf of Mexico to Pennsylvania. And hence, our dew points, that's a measure of water vapor in the air, have been very high. The dew point this morning is around 72, 73. That's a New Orleans-like dew point in September, and it's here in Lancaster. And so that rich moisture that we've had is obviously fuel for the showers. So when you get those typical summer afternoon showers and thunderstorms, which we've had a lot of in July and August, instead of dropping a half an inch or an inch of rain, they've been dropping an inch or two or three or four or more of rain, and then day in and day out, that adds up. And so, for instance, in Harrisburg, the official rainfall for June, July, and August was a little over 21 inches. That's measured at the airport. That is more than half a year's worth of rain in 3 months. So that's a heck of a lot of rain. And then here in September already, Harrisburg's picked up another 4.36 inches. So since June 1st, we're now approaching a total of 26 in Harrisburg. And, of course, there's outlying areas, places that have been hit harder, you know, over towards Hershey and up in central Dauphin County, where back on July 24th, 25th, some places had up to 15 or 16 inches of rain just in a few days. So I'm sure there's some spots up there that probably have a total that's 10 inches above what the airport in Harrisburg has mentioned.
Well, yeah, of course.
And in that case, you know, it's record rainfall. And
yeah, of course,
so,
2 weeks ago.
It's been unusual, no doubt about it.
2 weeks ago in Mount Joy and Mannheim, that storm was 2 weeks ago today. One final question is not related to the... Well, wait, before we get to this final question, this was from a listener, but I'm sure one of the questions that many people have is, when will that pattern end? Do we know? Do you see any, I don't know, pleasant days in the future?
Well, again, this weekend should be mainly dry because we will have high pressure protecting us, but it is going to be muggy and it is going to be warm, so it's not going to be a fall-like weekend, that's for sure. In terms of when will some cooler, drier air get in here and maybe get a break from the showers, well, I see some signs that maybe the jet stream may try to shift a little bit right around, ironically, the first day of fall, the autumnal equinox, which occurs on September 22nd. So that's, what, next Saturday.
Wow.
I see a sign that maybe the jet stream pattern tries to shift on along, you know, next weekend. Until then, we're going to stay in the warm, muggy air. Obviously, we have that Tuesday concern for the remnants of Florence coming our way. So we're going to add more to our rain totals before maybe we shift into a cooler, drier pattern.
Okay, here's the final question. Thomas in Manheim Township asked, and this is totally separate, but a lot of people maybe even thinking ahead to winter. He'd like to know if you have an idea of what type of El Nino could develop, a normal type El Nino, or is it Madaki El Nino? And what could mean for snow and cold?
That's some impressive nuance there from our questioner. El Nino is the periodic warming. It's a natural cycle, a shifting of warm water across the Pacific towards the coast of South America. And depending just where the warmest water sets up, is it in the eastern Pacific or more in the central Pacific, determines what type of El Nino it is. And I think it's a little too early to say how strong and just which type it's going to be, but just the fact that there is an El Nino building, we can see the warming starting in the Pacific. That is something that, based on past decades of tracking El Nino and wintertime patterns, there's a pretty strong correlation with an enhanced southern storm track across the United States. And so that enhanced southern storm track probably means, dare I say, a wetter and perhaps whiter than normal winter. A lot of storm potential. It's not guaranteed to be, all snow nor all rain. I mean, it's rare. Most winters we get both, and I think that'll be the case this winter. Probably a stormy winter due to El Nino, but just the overall flavor, like how cold will the winter be, and how robust that southern storm track will be, I think we need to wait until about the beginning of November to really see the state of the Pacific then, and also some other clues, like what's going on in Siberia and near the North Pole will become revealed by then. So maybe we should talk, Scott, back around when we get to around November 1st, and we can actually nail down a good, solid winter outlook at that time.
Maybe we'll stop raining by then, Eric.
Let's hope so.
Eric Hurst is the director of the Millersville University Weather Information Center. Eric, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. A while back on this program, a downtown planner told us that successful downtown cities or towns had to have a craft brewery or business that served craft beers. And it's an example of just how popular craft beers have become. And Pennsylvania leads the nation by producing 3.9 million barrels of beer a year. Craft beer has become an economic impact in this state as well, or has an economic impact, I should say, of nearly $6 billion. Craft beer is our topic today. We know you have a lot of questions and comments about this. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Joining us is Aaron Miskell and David Kozlowski, co-owners of Gearhouse Brewing Company in Chambersburg. Aaron and David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good morning. We're happy to be here.
Also joining us is Carrie Fisher-Lepore. She's Deputy Secretary of Marketing, Tourism, and Film with the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development. Carrie, good to see you again.
Very happy to be here today.
You have been saving that for several days, haven't you? Maybe you've used it before, right?
Maybe once or twice.
Okay. All right. Well, see, I want, when you're on this program, I want something unique. So come up with something else.
Okay.
Tom Ford, commercial horticulture educator with the Penn State Extension. Mr. Ford, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to tell you, Tom and Aaron, or David and Aaron, after listening to that weather forecast and what we're in right now, maybe it's good for you because it's raining, they can go indoors, your customers, but it's so humid that people are looking for a cold beer.
Beverage,
there
yeah.
you go. All right, well, let me start off by talking about that popularity. I mentioned that planner that was on the program said, we are convinced, and by we, she meant city, town planners, downtowns, that you must have a craft brewery or an establishment that serves craft beer to be successful. It's just a good example of why craft beer, it draws people and how popular it is. Why do you think craft beer is so popular today?
I'm going to take that, actually. The social background of beer and imbibing and drinking beer with your family and friends is something that has been a long, long history within the country. Long before our founding fathers even wrote the Declaration of Independence, most of them were either making wine on properties or making beer on their own properties, including William Penn, one of our founding fathers in the state. We're not entirely always positive what it is that brings everybody to the table except that glass of beer in their hand. And then once they have that experience, as long as it's positive, it continues and it grows from there.
I really think that it's so much more about the, or not more perhaps necessarily, but so much about the community gathering spaces that we are able to provide. So in our organization, we are, we have about a 3,000 square foot tap room that's spread over a couple of different spaces, and customers can come in and there can be sort of smaller private spaces where they can hang out, or they can hang out at the bar and sort of get to hang out in our small town with people they see regularly and some that they don't, with people who come perhaps because they've heard about us via the Cumberland Valley Beer Trail or some other, you know, beer tourism, which is so popular right now. But really, I think one of the other things that's very valuable to our consumers, I think, is the fact that David, our brewer, is able to be out on the floor talking to people. So our customers are really our friends, and they see us as their friends, and we love them as our friends.
So the size, I mean, no one from Miller Coors or Budweiser or any of the imports will be out on the floor talking to customers.
No.
So the small, you know, how small your business is, even though it's growing,
sure,
but being able to have that one-on-one. But something you said, Aaron, I mean, people, yes, have always gathered, whether it's in bars, taverns, tap rooms. What's different now about, but they've gathered, they've had, you know, mixed drinks, they've had beers that are on tap, but what's different now about it?
I've been thinking about this a lot. I think one of the things is the sort of more personalized experience. I'm not sure that's all of it, for sure, but I really think that people who feel like they can walk in and give direct feedback to David is valuable too. And I think that the innovation that we are able to provide, and our wonderful craft beer colleagues in the state are able to provide, is really important. I think that people love to walk in and look up on our board every single time they come in and see a new beer. Mm. And I think that's a really interesting experience.
So that
for
variety
a lot of customers.
Is really important to your customers as well. So how did the two of you, how did Gearhouse come about?
We met some mutual friends at a house party, actually, a few years back, and they were the only others at the party drinking craft beer. I was currently a brewer at Flying Dog down in Frederick, Maryland at the time, so we had plenty of Flying Dog beer at our whim. We were trading stories and trading beers, and suddenly we started having dinner together, and then that snowballed into meeting some other friends, and now the six of us, three married couples, have created Gearhouse. We started it as a concept around 2015. We got the building the end of 2015, and we physically opened our doors to the public in 2016.
So how big have you become? How many barrels?
Last year, we did 375 barrels for our first full year production run. Mm-hmm. This year, we're trying for 400. So,
I'm always curious as to brewers, what motivates you? How do you get your ideas? How do you get an idea of, okay, here's what I'm trying to do? Or do you experiment?
A little bit of both. I definitely put it to the rest of our team and some of our staff as well to make suggestions all the time about what is selling. As Aaron mentioned, I try to be out on the floor and get that feedback directly from the customers, but of course I can't be there every single day. So our staff is very good at interacting with our customers, as the staff at many other breweries across the state, making sure that that customer understands what it is that they want or that they're looking for. And then with that, they give that information back to the brewers so that they can either continue to evolve that recipe or maybe start over or maybe just do something else as a side project and try and have fun with that too.
You know, something I saw one time that is probably a good analogy is that just like food in a restaurant, that those who come into a craft brewery tell people like you, David, what they like, what they're looking for, and you serve something that may meet their needs that they like, and they can experiment and that kind of thing. So that's probably a pretty good analogy, wouldn't you think?
I do think so. Being a brewer is a culmination of experiences, especially in sensory profile, and understanding where those ingredients come into play, how they come into play, how to best utilize them, and make them shine as part of a big, complex group.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, they brought samples, but I can't drink anything while I'm over here at the board. But
that's
I have to tell
bad.
You, I know. And you, that's fresh, right?
It's fresh. I filled these at 7 a.m.
What do you have?
We brought with us two of our Crowlers. This is a 32-ounce to-go package we offer to our customers. Many other breweries across the state use these same cans. This is 2 pints, effectively, in one can. It's great, packable, easy to carry, easy to keep cold, single-use transaction. So we brought 2 different beers in these. One of these is my Mad Machinist, our double IPA. We have an excellent logo that our tattoo artist and one of our local customers came up with
for that. I see that Aaron has that tattoo.
Same tattoo artist, actually. The other beer that we brought with us is a little more of a breakfast beer and kind of segues into some more of the conversation today. We have a PA Preferred Registered Nathan Miller Chocolate Porter. So this beer was made with not just chocolate from one of our other local small businesses in Chambersburg, Nathan Miller Chocolate, but also we have malt from Pennsylvania. We have hops from Pennsylvania that went into this beer as well.
And we're going to talk about hops in Pennsylvania in just a few minutes. But, you know, maybe I should define this, or you should define this, because there may be people who haven't caught on to the craft beer craze yet. What is a craft beer?
Craft beer is specifically defined by the Brewers Association as a independently owned, below 6 million barrels a year operation. So you can't have a corporation-owned entity. You can't be part of a commodity enterprise or anything like that.
Is Yingling, what was that? Was that? There wasn't a can of beer.
No, it was a water bottle.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay, good. Want to make sure.
Close top.
You never
want
to lose beer on the floor.
No. These aren't even open yet.
I know. Is Yingling a craft beer?
Yes, Yingling is qualified as a craft beer, and they are actually getting ready to celebrate 190 years continuously running in 2019.
Because they're independently owned?
Because they're independently family-owned, yes.
Okay, all right, because they, I don't know how many barrels they produce, but
They make up the majority of what we produce in our state. They were a little over 3 million barrels, I believe, for 2017. Mm. And then the rest of our close to 300 operating breweries in the state at that time made up the majority of the rest of that. But we are number one in barrel production currently, outpacing California even, which is impressive.
By far, I think,
yeah.
Outpacing California. And obviously, they have a much larger population. I want to take a question here from Jim in Lancaster, and then we'll go into tourism and what many people are doing here in Pennsylvania on beer trails. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you folks today?
We're doing very well.
Good morning, Jim.
Good. I would like to echo a lot of the comments that I heard earlier. I've seen over and over where craft breweries really do have a significant impact on the local neighborhood in a positive manner.
In what way?
To that point, well, just because it's the point generally is not intoxication, but enjoyment of the product.
Correct.
So, you know, there's people that are attracted, that are you know, very interested in craft beer, and so it attracts a good crowd, a crowd that's willing to spend some money. It's just a positive effect.
Thank you very much for your call. And that leads us into the next part of our conversation. Carrie Fisher-Lepore is Deputy Secretary of Marketing, Tourism, and Film with the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development. Carrie, I think he led perfectly into our part of the conversation. This has become, craft beer has become a real draw for tourism in Pennsylvania. And when I say tourism, not just people traveling from out of state or traveling miles to try out some of these beers, but just in the neighborhood, there are a lot of people who are spending money in Pennsylvania on craft beer, and it's become big business.
Absolutely, and I'm so thrilled to hear that last caller, I believe his name was Jim, talk about the impact that it's having on local communities. I don't think that we can highlight that enough. Excuse me. These brew pubs and microbreweries and tap rooms are really providing these neighborhoods with a community gathering place, just like David and Aaron have talked about. But so often we see this happening in some of our post-industrial communities. These breweries are moving into old manufacturing plants, shuttered buildings, blighted buildings, and they are literally transforming these communities. They're serving as a catalyst for a rebirth, and it's also providing a new narrative for these communities. It's no longer that old story. It's a new chapter in so many of these communities.
Is it big enough economically that many of these older communities, and often, I think of old steel towns or industrial towns that are described as Rust Belt cities or towns.
I like to say post-industrial.
Okay. But, is craft beer big enough economically, have a big enough impact in Pennsylvania? You can say that it's bringing these places back?
Absolutely. And I don't, I know that it is a very big business economically. It's a huge contributor on our economy right now.
$6 billion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is an impressive, impressive number. And I think we're going to continue to see that number grow through the years. But again, I think what it provides the community from a moral standpoint, that these communities are believing in themselves. Last summer, I was in Washington, Pennsylvania, and there was a married couple who owned a winery. The husband was a home brewer, and they bought the building next door, and they were going to open up a brewery. And they were saying, as you know, the winery, and now there's going to be a brewery, and they're going to serve food there. It's giving people a reason to stay downtown when so often so many of these smaller cities and towns, the sidewalks kind of rolled up at 5 o'clock once that business day was over. Now we're creating gathering places for the community to come together and to stay downtown. And it's also helping, I think, with attracting people to move into these communities and to feel good about where they live.
Your customers, I'm curious, Aaron, younger, older? I mean, is there a demographic? Or
there really isn't, which is so interesting to us and so exciting. We have, we certainly have younger folks, but typically not too young. We do occasionally see early 20s, but most of our folks are people with a little bit more disposable income. But there is certainly no sort of upper age limit. We really, mostly 30s and 40s, but we certainly see both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Reason I asked that question, Carrie, is because one of the trends that we have seen over the last few years is younger people who are looking for entertainment moving into, whether it's cities, whether it's towns, boroughs, that tend to move back into those areas where there is more entertainment. And many of these craft breweries or the restaurants, the establishments serving craft beer, that's one of the things that's attracting them. Part of that is what you mentioned earlier about the social aspect of it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is no longer a niche market. It is a cultural phenomenon. It is something that we see so many people taking part in every day. Every time they travel to Pennsylvania, people are coming here for a quote beercation. We see a lot of people coming here.
A beercation.
For a beercation.
So if I would have said that 20 years ago, people would have thought I was a lush or something like that. But nowadays, it's different.
And it's funny that you say that, Scott.
Always in moderation.
Yes, absolutely.
There you go.
But it's no longer about these like drunken, bar hopping experiences.
Exactly.
These are well-educated, wealthy people who are coming here with a lot of disposable income, who are looking for that authentic experience. And they also, talk about things like palate and notes in beer, and they are educated on
sensory
what they're
profile
drinking.
And flavor and malt and hops.
I know. You go to an establishment like yours, like your house, and say, and I'm sure you've asked this question. Well, do you like something hoppy?
Yes, always.
Right. Yeah, right.
If you're serving your community well as a brewer, you're going to find out what it is that they want.
And so what questions do you ask, David?
So typically I like to ask, what do they normally drink? Mm-hmm. If they're not a beer fan already, what do they normally go to at their 5 o'clock hour? If they're a wine fan, maybe we have something like a barley wine or a Belgian quad, a big, robust, mm-hmm. heavier beer that's a little boozier because they like that flavor. Maybe they're vodka tonic drinkers. Maybe they want something really clear and light, and you want to start them with a lager that doesn't really have too much in the way of flavor. But it's a matter of that culminated experience of sensory. You tasted all of these things and memorized all of these flavors and smells over the years, and that's part of my job, is putting all of that together for that experience for that specific customer.
So, Carrie, I'm going to go back to the tourism aspect of this. We have beer trails. Just a few years ago, wine trails were, and by the way, something else I've noticed is that there are a lot of brewers who, I say a lot, okay, it's a subjective term, description, but there are a lot that do both, wine, make wine, and also brew beer. But we have now beer trails in Pennsylvania, and the state is getting in on the action. $700,000 grant just a while back. What's that money going for? Why is it so important?
Absolutely. I wish we received $700,000. We didn't receive that much at all. We received about $125,000.
Oh, really?
Create a Pursue Your Hoppiness beer experience in Pennsylvania. There are so many destination marketing organizations and beer guilds and brewers that are coming together to create these fantastic experiences, these fantastic beer experiences in Pennsylvania, whether that's beer trails, beer festivals, food and beer pairings within breweries, things like that. What we hope to do at this state is serve as a central point for people who are coming to Pennsylvania, again, whether they're looking for that beercation, where that's the motivator for coming, or people who are coming to go whitewater rafting or do, you know, a battlefield tour but want to visit a brewery while they're here. We want to be that main point of entry for people. They can come to visit PA.com. They can click on the tourism region that they're visiting and find all of the beer trails available within that region, that they're going to find every brewery within that region. They'll also find what hotels to stay at, what they should do in addition to visiting the breweries and having that great authentic experience, maybe some farm-to-table restaurants to complement their trip. But also we hope to do some storytelling and to really dig a little deeper into why beer in Pennsylvania is so popular and why we think that we should be one of the top beer destinations in the entire country.
Speaking of which, we got a call from Chip in Lancaster. Says he's the former director of the Downtown Development Authority in Fort Collins, Colorado, known as the Napa Valley of beer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we had many craft brewers and other things that contributed to the downtown, like the university, high-tech industry. I think Colorado State is there. And his point is that craft beer is a contributor, but not to the entire shebang. Enlightened retailers are an imperative. And I think that's just what you describe, Sherry, is that what may draw people downtown to begin with, and it may be not even to begin with, but it is part of the community that gets people downtown, and apparently it is a vital part of the community mm-hmm. nowadays.
Absolutely, yes. And it's funny, I think Chip is calling in from Lancaster, you said?
Yes.
According to Travelocity, who's now doing like a beer index, Lancaster ranked like number 19 in the top mid-market beer destination index.
Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty awesome.
Don't quote me on that exactly. I encourage your listeners to Google that.
We're going to talk about the agricultural aspect of this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. During this portion of the program, we're talking about craft beers. Our guest, Tom Ford, commercial horticultural educator with the Penn State Extension, Carrie Fisher-Lepore, Deputy Secretary of Marketing, Tourism, and Film with the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development, and Aaron Miskell and David Kozlowski, co-owners of Gearhouse Brewing Company in Chambersburg. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.com. smarttalkwytf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwytf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Have a couple emails here before I turn to Tom Ford. Chris in Lancaster says, I turned 21 in 1986. My grandfather's beer was blah, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He says Pabst and Ballantine. My dad's beer was blah, Genesee. So initially, I began buying only imports, which had some taste, which had some gusto. The Yingling Lager woke me up to the fact that the USA could make something with color and taste. Sierra Nevada found its way to Pennsylvania, and the revolution was on. Best wishes to your guest. Can I find their beer here?
Actually, we are on at the Lancaster Barnstormer Stadium, so you certainly can there. We occasionally are on at the Bull's Head in Lititz, but I encourage you to come to Chambersburg, start your day there. We offer lunch. You can come in right at noon on a Saturday and slow roll your way home to Lancaster, visiting a few of the breweries up in Carlisle, a few in Mechanicsburg and Harrisburg, and just sort of work your way home and start use us as your starting point.
Do you compete with other brewers?
No, we collaborate. We love the partnership. That's one of the things that we love so much about this industry is the way that we work together. We rely on each other for answers and ingredients and partnership and advice and share customers.
Jeremy in Chambersburg asks, I wonder how much Pennsylvania's Dark Ages liquor laws, his words, have contributed to such a vibrant craft beer industry in the state.
Ooh.
These establishments aren't required to have the same kind of very expensive liquor licenses that traditional restaurants with full bars must have, an unintended but actually positive consequence, possibly. Thanks for the great brew and great places in Chambersburg Gearhouse.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. That's very kind of you.
That's a real thought. I know you want to get over to Mr. Ford, but
go ahead about the laws.
Yeah, we're really fortunate to work in a state that is so welcoming to our industry. And it really, especially, it's very well highlighted when you look at a state like Maryland, which is not doing a great job supporting its craft beer industry right now. We in Pennsylvania have a very strong guild as well, the Brewers of Pennsylvania, which really has pressed for us to have a number of wonderful privileges, including being able to sell what we call internally OPP, other people's products. Gearhouse and many of our many other organizations in the state are able to offer cider, wine, and spirits made in Pennsylvania. So we can really offer you a full bar experience when you come to the brewery. We do craft cocktails. We do, you know, wonderful wines and ciders made here in Pennsylvania by other great craft manufacturers. Go ahead.
That's thrilling to hear. And I think Governor Wolf really understands and acknowledges the impact craft brewing has on Pennsylvania's economy. In fact, just this past few weeks ago, Governor Wolf declared September as Pennsylvania Craft Beer Month. This is the first year of receiving such a declaration, and I think it's really a sign that Governor Wolf understands and respects the impact. We did a video with Governor Wolf and Secretary Dennis Stavin from DCED, Department of Community and Economic Development, and Russell Redding, the Secretary of Agriculture, highlighting the importance. And it's funny because Governor Wolf had a glass of Liquid Hero, which is
nice.
Brewed right in downtown New York. So, I mean, he really, really gets it, and it's nice to hear you say that.
So, this designation as Craft Beer Month in Pennsylvania, is that like a happy hour thing? I mean, is there any, like, reduced prices or anything?
This is our first year. As I said, it's the inaugural.
Well, think about that for next year.
You
right?
bet,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
I'll add that to the list.
Let's go to Tom Ford now. He's a commercial horticulture educator with the Penn State Extension, and he is not there. There you are, Tom.
I'm still here, yeah.
Okay. All right. So hops production has increased in Pennsylvania. But just a while back, I remember hearing that we were having a hop shortage. Talk about hops production in Pennsylvania. How big of an industry is this?
Right now, hops in Pennsylvania is relatively small. We're dealing with probably under 200 acres as far as hops production. If we went back to the entire Mid-Atlantic and northeastern states, they look at the turn of the century, the 1900s actually, 1920s, and so you typically, the industry relocated because of disease pressure. And so no research was done, basically the crop was dropped as a viable ag alternative within the Mid-Atlantic corridor. It wasn't until the hop shortages plus the growth of the craft brewery industry that fueled the fire to say, hey, can we do local hops production? And there are a lot of economic barriers, but there are also pest and disease barriers that are also very difficult to get through. And so the quality of the hops that we produce is rather it's kind of challenging at this time. Wet year like this, a lot of the hops producers were dealing with significant disease pressure. So a lot of the cones are showing alternaria. They're showing other types of injury. There was lots of downy mildew this year. So in order to get the local hops production up to where we can meet demand, we need over 1,000 acres in Pennsylvania. And so we're taking baby steps moving forward, but when it costs you $20,000 plus an acre to establish hops, and then at least $15,000 plus for the hop harvester, and we're not even thinking about pelletizing equipment and some of the other stuff that's out there, it becomes a very expensive proposition. And what we're finding is that growers have the interest, but in some cases, the economic barriers really kind of put a wall between them and getting started.
The Pennsylvania Malt and Brewed Beverages Industry Promotion Board recently awarded Penn State 2 grants geared toward improving hop production. Can you tell us about those grants? You mentioned that we need more acreage out there in Pennsylvania. Will those grants help?
Well, there's actually a couple of things going on. Up until about 3 years ago, there was no hops research being done in Pennsylvania. We received Penn State hops team received a specialty block grant. So we actually have a variety trial of 15 different varieties at the Rock Springs research farm up there outside of State College. And so we're trialing these 15 varieties. We're looking at their performance. We're looking at their vigor. We're looking at disease pressure. We'll be eventually working with some of the nutrient management issues because each variety is unique and different. And what we're trying to do is try to come up with the varietal list that will actually perform well within Pennsylvania. The variety that pretty much everyone starts with, the gateway hops, is probably Cascade, because Cascade has the best disease resistance, typically has the best vigor, best yield, but Cascade now probably has one of the lowest prices because it is just so overplanted. It's not something a lot of the breweries have on their short list. They want something usually maybe a little bit more unique, and a lot of times, some cases, even proprietary. And so we're finding some of the varieties that are in demand, unfortunately, do not do particularly well with Pennsylvania weather.
Right. David, you've been nodding your head. You use Pennsylvania hops?
We not only use Pennsylvania hops, we actually have some hops on our property. We have 3 varieties currently that are planted in the ground and established about 2 years ago. So we're just starting to get our first, you know, full-strength, viable crop from it. But we're focused on using Pennsylvania ingredients as much as possible. So we've actually worked with Adam Dellinger at Sunny Bray, the guys at Thirsty Farmer, the Nouse family. We have some hops from them that we have utilized all of these sources and tried to put PA ingredients into our beer where possible.
We only have a couple minutes left. I'm going to try to get in a couple questions here from listeners. Mike in Lebanon asks, what do you think the secondary market and beer trading, how it will affect the industry in PA?
I really don't know a ton about it. I think that people being excited about craft beer in any circumstance is a great thing for us all. I tend to sort of generally not be very interested in waiting in long lines for beer or looking for those, you know, whales. I really personally am much more interested in visiting my local, you know, wherever I am, the actual breweries, more than looking for those, you know, rarefied whales of beer.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank you very much. Actually, we do only have about a minute left. I had to do my math here. I do this every day. But I want to thank all of you for being with us today. This sounds like a bright future. There's a bright future out there.
We'd like to think so.
Why do you think so?
Again, beer is a social animal. Everybody's been gathering around beer since we discovered beer in the first place. And we, as breweries, bring so much back to our communities. We're revitalizing economic impact. We're bringing jobs to our communities. We're bringing money into the state. We're providing money for the state budget even at some points. So,
how many people do you employ? Gearhouse.
Gearhouse has 15 employees, 7 of which are full-time currently.
Okay. So, and you multiply that by the number of local brewers.
Right.
Not huge, but it's getting there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, want to thank all of you for being with us today. Aaron Miskell, David Kozlowski, co-owners of Gearhouse Brewing Company in Chambersburg. And I have to tell you, looking over there at those cans with the little...
condensation drops.
Condensation on the side. That looks great. Carrie Fisher-Laporte with the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development. Tom Ford, commercial horticultural educator with Penn State Extension. Thank all of you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Monday's program, we're going to be talking with the very serious topic. You probably heard that horrific story of five sisters that were sexually abused. Catholic Church, that comes up. The five are going to be with us on Monday.